that I do. I started working on it immediately after the trip. I spent a month in 2022 in September in the West Bank, in many places, in many cities. That's why I went for a month, because I needed to have time to move while knowing all the time restrictions that there are on movement due to the issue of the wall and the checkpoints, the military checkpoints and the movement control that is always there. And during the trip, I took a lot of photographic recording from an amateur's place. I'm not a professional photographer, but with a camera, a good camera that I bought, I started my work and I wrote a memory of the trip. And upon returning, talking with Andrea Guidash about the trip, we set out to generate this experience. Then I began to write a text, which came out like that, like a whirlwind, just like that. That is, as if the text was written right from the heart of the experiences I had, from the premises of the history of the experience, of something that my aunts and uncles had told me before the trip. Those who had already gone there would always say that your life is always going to be divided before and after visiting Palestine. I thought they were exaggerating about this claim, and what I thought hit me in the face, because my life did become a before and after of Palestine. And that is why I decided to name the work Irreversible Palestine, at the same time as non-existent Palestine. That's because one sees there, before their very eyes, the reality of the operation that the regime of Israel is fulfilling, that it's erasing Palestine. What you have seen is the terrible videos out there, appears before your eyes as an irrefutable reality. This manifests in a genocide that is currently taking place in an intensified way in the Gaza Strip. In fact, this has been happening there for more than 75 years. But it's not limited to taking lives in Palestine, but cultural genocide, which has to do with the memory and the history of that place. And then I decided to make a travel chronicle, but theatrically. And this travel chronicle works with the irreversibility of the Palestinian experience, the problem of erasure and what they want to make disappear, the need to make appear what they want to make disappear, and the relationships that can be found between processes that are being experienced there of the regime's violence against the people, with state violence against the people that occurs here in Latin America as well. And that is not a strange idea of mine that has occurred to me from nothing, but it is something that you talk about with the activists there. It is very beautiful to see certain networks of solidarity that exist from the refugee camps with places of struggle and resistance here in Latin America.
In Gualmapu. Asma was in Gualmapu and was working in workshops with indigenous people in Chile.
Exactly, and you see that in the wall too, which is like a reinforced concrete segregation wall, 8 meters high, 810 kilometers long, and that is dividing at the same time as being a kind of gigantic panegyric of the desire for solidarity and of justice for the people. And the Palestinian struggle is there. The struggle of Afro-descendant peoples in the United States, the struggle of Afro peoples in Brazil, the struggle of the Mapuche.
In Western Sahara.
In Western Sahara too. So this is theatricalized conference because we play with a conference format, but it begins to be theatricalized. It works with that too, with the relationships between there and here. One of the most effective experiences I had during my trip was from a feminist activist named Laura Abualta. She told me a phrase that I never forgot, which is in the text of the work as well. She told me, "They are with the governments of the world, and we are with the people of the world." And I think there is a key to continue thinking about what to do in this current dark moment.
Thank you very much, Anna, for accepting this invitation and for giving us all these insights. I invite you to take a break, and then we'll return.
A pesar de la imagen
Despite the image that the West has always wanted to portray about the Arab world, through the distorting lens of the Crusades, the role of Palestinian women has been fundamental in the liberation struggle, not only national, but of the entire Arab nation, and goes back to the beginning of the last century. We cannot fail to remember the Palestinian women, both Muslim and Christian, who signed the declaration against the Balfour Declaration of November 2, 1917, when the British government handed over Palestine for free to the World Zionist Organization, and we cannot leave it in the past. We cannot forget them. Women like Leila Khaled, like Maryam Abu Bakr, like Fatima Parnagui, like Doris Jury, like Jadiya As-Salman, like Amal Hamnel and Ahed Tamimi, and the young woman who slapped an Israeli soldier in the face and spent several months in prison, and Fadda Tukan, one of the most relevant Palestinian poets. There, of course, are those who also play a role today, such as Hanan Ashrawi, who was part of the mission that negotiated a possibility of peace that the Israelis, Zionism, and the West have squandered time and again to this day. In Palestine, being a woman is resisting. Existing is resisting. Our tribute goes to all those who are no longer here, those who are there, and those in the future who will be the ones who will see Palestine free. I offer the floor so that you may want to ask questions about the topic in discussion.
Muchas gracias por la invitación. Me llamo Pierre Capanera.
Thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Pierre Capanera. I'm the correspondent in Chile of the communist newspaper of Humanity of Paris. My question is, during the first Intifada, there was a very important participation of women in Palestine, and not only men. What is the reason for this situation?
Yo no creo que haya habido un punto de inflexión.
I do not believe that there was a turning point in women's participation in the national liberation struggle before and after the Intifada. Perhaps one could assume that in past times the protagonism, especially in the media, was carried out mostly by men, but there is no doubt that Palestinian women, even long before the Intifada, participated in all forms of struggle in the resistance. Palestinian nation and all the Palestinian political parties has played a role not only in the territorial disputes and the armed confrontations, but also in the maintenance of culture and in the projection to the future of culture. In all these challenges, women have played a fundamental role in passing on the pride of being a Palestinian from one generation to the new generations, and have made a fundamental contribution by culture. It's not just these points, though. The roles that the Palestinian women play are not apart from their birth rate. They have a birth rate that is almost three times higher than the birth rate of Israeli women. And it is an undeniable fact that one of the main challenges towards the future of the Zionist project is their population. They know that without a generation, they will never be able to be the majority, and this is a real problem. We shouldn't forget about the strength, determination, capacity, and also the level of professionalization that Palestinian women have had, who, for the same reasons of the conflict, have had absolutely majority access to the university compared to Palestinian men. Palestinian men, due to the same culture, are much more destined to support the family, in quotes, and it has always been in recent decades, women have been privileged to enter university, which is generating a fundamental change. When today one looks at local governments, the Palestinian National Authority, non-governmental organizations, the vast majority of them are occupied and in the main positions by women. The Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Culture are a fundamental pillar of the resistance, but also a fundamental pillar that allows us to look to the future with great peace of mind.
Hola, mi nombre es Denise.
Hello, my name is Denise. Thanks for the invitation. Based on her experience of the trip to Palestine, what role do you think women play in the fight against the Zionist occupation?
Muchas gracias, Denise.
Thank you very much, Denise. The truth is that I feel that today there is no space for Palestinian resistance, both armed and political, also in the construction of the state, in the attempt to build a state from the base that is prohibited from the fullest participation of women. Palestinian women play a fundamental role. They emigrate less than Palestinian men who seek new horizons to be able to continue helping their families from abroad, and today they constitute an essential network in the small apparatus of the state that functions at different national and subnational levels. When one looks at the ministries, when one looks at local governments, when one even looks at the role of schools and some public policies, they see that women are the main protagonists in the field of culture, in the field of journalism, and in the field of professionalization of the Palestinian people. Palestinian women have recently worked in politics. In the field of politics, they have had a much higher rate of admission to university than men, for reasons that are complex to explain, but that is changing the face of decision-making, decision with the Palestinian people, and we hope that in the future this will also deepen.
La mujer palestina hoy día está...
The Palestinian women today are being murdered. We want to make a call from Palestinian society, from the Palestinian people to the world feminist movement, not to remain silent, not to forget, and not to forgive. A new March 8th is approaching, and we hope that everyone on March 8th will dress as a Palestinian, and that the feminist movement plays a fundamental role in the unrestricted defense, not only of Palestinian women, but also of their right to self-determination at the end of the occupation and the definitive end of this genocide that has been going on for more than 75 years. Our tribute, our heartfelt gratitude goes to all the Palestinian women who today are pillars of the resistance. We dedicate this program to them, and we hope that in the future they continue contributing to the dissemination of the reality of Palestinian women in the world.
De la mujer palestina en el mundo.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations office in Geneva, Switzerland has categorically censured the ongoing crackdown on pro-Palestine demonstrators across the United States, stressing that violence against peaceful protesters will not silence them. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The New York Times has covered this story and tells us more. More than 100 imams and religious scholars have declared solidarity with pro-Palestinian protest encampments at major American universities. Inspired by protests at Columbia University in New York, hundreds of students have set up protest encampments on at least a dozen college campuses from Massachusetts to California to protest Israel's savage war on the Gaza Strip. Several schools have called the police on protesters, leading to the arrests of hundreds of students since last week. On Friday, 26th of April, more than 135 imams and religious scholars signed a statement saying they admire the students' courageous actions and various sacrifices for Palestine. The statement read, "May your efforts be a beacon of hope and transformation, inspiring further actions towards a just and equitable world." The recent escalatory encampments by students on campuses across the country calling for divestment and solidarity with Palestine reflect the students' commitment to holding the American university system accountable for aiding and abetting genocide in Gaza. They said police violent crackdown on pro-Palestine protesters across the country signals how support for Israel has reached an impasse, whereby it cannot sustain itself without draconian measures to silence dissent. Protests on U.S. college campuses have sparked since Israel launched its brutal military offensive on the besieged Gaza Strip in October of last year. The demonstrations gained momentum when President Joe Biden approved a further $26 billion in war aid for the Israeli regime on Wednesday, 24th of April. Across the United States, protesters have vowed to keep their demonstrations going unless the leadership of their universities cut all financial ties with the Israeli regime, whose brutal war has massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians. The Daily Star has also covered the same story and tells us more. Police in the United States has broken up yet another encampment set up in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip for enduring a Washington-backed Israeli war of genocide. The incident took place at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts on Saturday, 27th of April. It saw police officers in riot gear detaining around 100 university students. The university alleged in a statement on the social media platform X, the action was taken after some protesters resorted to violent anti-Semitic slurs. Many U.S. officials have been trying to accuse the pro-Palestinian student protesters as anti-Semitic. However, observers assert that the students are only trying to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its atrocities in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinians have been massacred as a result of the war, which has now raged on for almost 7 months, and also press Washington to drop its political, military, and intelligence support of the Israeli regime. The crackdown was the latest in a series of confrontations between law enforcement and the students, during which police officers have rounded up hundreds of people and at times used chemical irritants and tasers. Also, on Saturday, 27th of April, the college president at the University of Pennsylvania ordered a similar encampment to be disbanded immediately. On Thursday, 25th of April, students at Yale and Columbia universities, where the protests originated, vowed to press on with their pro-Palestinian activism at the universities as long as the United States sustained its unreserved support for Israel's war in Gaza. The students issued a statement saying, "This is only the beginning. Pushing the university's struggle to its limit might contribute in a similar way to producing a constellation of revolutionary forces in the city today." Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. The students' union of the leading Indian university has shown its support for the pro-Palestinian protests occurring at American universities, criticizing the police's harsh response towards the protesting students and calling for the charges against the students to be dropped. The country's prestigious Jawaharlal Nehru University Student Union expressed its unwavering solidarity with the students at Columbia University in New York, United States, where demonstrations in support of Palestine broke out on 17th of April and are courageously raising their voices against Israel's war and genocide in Gaza. It said the students of the American University are calling for removal of companies that are profiting from the Israeli-led genocide over Gaza. Soon the demonstration spread like wildfire across various other campuses across the United States. The student's body said in a statement, "It is deeply concerning that instead of engaging in dialogue, the Columbia University administration is resorting to repressive tactics." The statement added, "We condemn the university's decision to suspend and arrest university students for exercising their right to protest. Furthermore, we condemn the Columbia University president, Minouche Shafiq's public call for the arrest of students on her own university campus. This action undermines the very essence of academic freedom and free speech." Incidents of confrontation with law enforcement have been reported during these protests. Numerous university students participating in the demonstrations have faced suspensions from their respective universities, while more than 500 individuals have been apprehended by police authorities. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations office in Geneva, Switzerland has categorically censured the ongoing crackdown on pro-Palestine demonstrators across U.S. universities, stressing that violence against peaceful university students will not silence them. Israel's U.S.-backed genocidal war on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip has passed its 200th day mark. Major American universities have been the scene of clashes between protesting students and police officers amid intensifying protests in condemnation of Israel's war on Gaza. Iran's permanent diplomatic mission to Geneva said in a post on its X social media account on Saturday, 27th of April, "We strongly condemn the brutal and violent crackdown on widespread peaceful pro-Palestinian protests at various universities in the United States. American police brutally and excessively use force against the peaceful protesters and target them." The statement called for an end to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Iran's permanent mission to Geneva added, "Demonstrators are precisely calling for ending the U.S. complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza in their name. Firing and beating peaceful protesters does not silence them. They're on the front line of human rights defenders, and it only reaffirms the urgency of the struggle for justice in Palestine." The statement added, "Police attacks against university students and university professors, the scale of the arrests and the conditions of detentions is deeply disturbing, and we call for the release of all those detained by police."
Economic divide.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill which could potentially lead to the nationwide ban on short video app TikTok, citing unfounded national security concerns due to its Chinese ownership. Now, it demands TikTok divest from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, or be shut out of the American market. For the second time, the bill is expected to go to the Senate for a vote. What is U.S. concern over TikTok? Well, that's what we'll be covering in this week's edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, the TikTok U.S. ban. The economic impact. The company, well, contributes $24.4 billion annually. In terms of small businesses, $14.7 billion. The U.S., is it targeting China? U.S. security paranoia may be in place here. Remember Huawei? Well, the U.S. targeted that company. And it also is targeting Chinese chip makers. And finally, U.S. trade approach. What's wrong with that picture? You have a trade war with China. You have sanctions and also countries that, because of the U.S. approach, are aligning against the U.S. All right, let me introduce our first guest for the program. Diane Sayre joins us. She's an independent candidate for the U.S. Senate from New York State. She's also a political analyst. Diane Sayre, welcome to Economic Divide.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Diane, the first question is an obvious one. You have a company that's a money-making company. It contributes not only in terms of jobs, creating jobs for Americans, but also it pays its taxes, a large share of it. And the question that comes about is, why is it that the U.S. wants to actually ban this company? It's almost as if it's shooting itself in the foot.
Well, I don't think the U.S., whatever that is, and the reason I say that is because we have a government that's not acting in the interest of our nation. We have a policy, the British liberal free trade system, which is really on its last legs. We have no credibility or authority. The United States' ongoing support for the genocide occurring in Gaza has made us really lose all credibility and moral standing. A regime which is weak needs to censor. They need to silence opposition. They need to silence opposing views. And I think that's really their concern, not the money or the economy. After all, we've been demonstrating for the last number of years that we can print money perfectly well.
Time now to take a look at some social media posts. First up, U.S. House reps hid the TikTok ban in the bill designed to provide aid to Israel, which is an insane sentence for many reasons, but the connection and the way it's being fast-tracked this Saturday, coming tomorrow, which it already has, well, it's something that is not lost on me, according to this particular post. Well, second one, it is unfortunate that the House of Representatives is using the cover of important foreign and humanitarian assistance to once again jam through a ban bill that would trample the free speech rights of 170 million Americans. These are the number of TikTok users. Devastate 7 million businesses and shutter a platform that contributes $24 billion to the U.S. economy annually. Then a video here where this guy says, or this post says, this guy is hilarious. With all the problems America is facing, the best the government can do is ban TikTok. Then House vote to either force the sale of TikTok or ban it entirely from the U.S. is the most dangerous and anti-American act since the passage of the Patriot Act. The law will give the U.S. president sole authority to determine which businesses can and cannot operate in the U.S. It is a full government takeover of our basic liberties. All right, those were some of the posts that we picked. And of course, it's quite understandable the outrage that some are feeling, especially the 170 million users that are using this app. Let me bring in our first guest. We have Steve Gill, a former White House trade advisor, who joins us. Steve Gill, welcome to Economic Divide.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Now, Steve Gill, when it comes to TikTok, I guess the question that really boggles the mind is the fact that you have a company that's making this money, is paying its taxes, quite a bit of it, and employs so many Americans, and therefore the contribution to the U.S. economy is really great. Then why is it that the U.S. is jeopardizing this this money that it's making by going through with a potential ban?
I think two things. First, it does provide a lot of economic benefit both to small businesses and to the tax base as well. But the big concern is twofold. One, whether the Chinese are collecting data, which is so important in the world today, from the information that people post on TikTok, the access that they give to TikTok, It's a security concern that they're gathering data from these individuals who may or may not be aware of it. And then what are they doing with that data? The second thing is that when you have access to our social media markets in the U.S., but we don't have access to your social media markets, there's an unfairness to that lack of balance. And I think that what we've seen in U.S. trade policy and other economic policies in the past is that the U.S. generally grants tremendous access to our markets in terms of trade, manufacturing, purchase of property, ownership of companies. And yet we are shut out of countries like China, where you have to have a Chinese partner that has more than half ownership of your company there, where American media outlets can't play in China, but TikTok has unfettered access in the U.S. So I think it's a matter of balance and fairness, which is why the attempt to silence TikTok has been met with some resistance in our Congress to make sure that this is about security and not censorship. I think that if China sells TikTok U.S. to another partner, that helps alleviate some of the concern about the access to data. At the end of the day, I think TikTok will survive in the U.S. in some form, and that economic benefit will continue in some form.
Time now for the Infant News section of the program. First off, we're going to take a look at how the Israeli regime is doing. And it's no surprise, really, another downgrade has been leveled against it by another rating agency. Confrontation with the Islamic Republic of Iran, well, that has raised geopolitical risks. That's Operation True Promise that Iran exercised in a retaliatory action against the Israeli regime. Now, these hostilities have prompted all three U.S. credit ratings agencies, namely Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, to place the Israeli regime on negative ratings watch. So, not good news for the Israeli regime. Next up, sanctions against Venezuela by the U.S. have been reimposed. A six-month reprieve has ended due to concerns surrounding, based on the U.S. side, concerns that is, for the upcoming presidential elections in the South American country. Now, Washington has described as Caracas's failure to adhere to democratic principles. The move comes as the nation is preparing for presidential elections. So you put two and two together. Upcoming presidential elections, the U.S. decides at this time to level the sanctions against Venezuela. Go figure. BRICS, the trade bloc, may have a new member. Colombia wants to join it. Brazil will promote its neighbor's candidacy. Some 25 countries at this point are expecting to apply for membership during the group's summit that's going to be held in the Russian city of Kazan in October. And since we just mentioned Russia's economy, let's find out how it's doing. Well, it's really surprising and shocking because it has now been revealed that Russia is going to grow faster than all advanced economies. That's according to the IMF. Russia's economy will grow faster than all of the world's advanced economies, including the U.S., this year. The IMF expects Russia to grow 3.2% this year, significantly more than the U.K., France, and Germany. Those were the items that we picked for the Info News section.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for the in-depth section of the program. When it comes to TikTok, this is a situation where the U.S. is trying to contain a company that's a moneymaker, whether it's for itself or the contribution that it makes, in this case, obviously, to the U.S. economy. So it's worth getting into the numbers and see how this money is being generated by this company and where it's going in order to then understand the dynamics behind why the U.S. would want such a money-making organization to be shut down or sold in the case where they're going to vote for it, and of which they have. So let's move on to the first set of numbers that we're going to look at next, the economic impact that the company has had on the U.S. economy. We're using four different categories: total, direct, indirect, and induced. Total contribution to the GDP for the year 2023 was $24.2 billion. Now, that's a big figure. I'm sure you'll agree. $9.2 billion in terms of the direct economic contribution that it's making, $6.6 billion, the indirect one, as you see here, and then $8.4 billion, which is the induced one. Now, the total of which you can see, $24.2 billion. So that gives you the overall picture of the contribution that this company not only makes in terms of the U.S. economy, but overall in terms of sales. So let's move on to the next screen now to get a better feel. In this case in point, what do we have? The total employment that's supported by the SMB. SMB is a small businesses in the U.S. The subcategories in terms of the jobs, direct, again, indirect, and induced, 98,000 jobs for the direct ones, for example. The total, grand total, being 225,000 jobs. Think about that, 225,000 jobs, okay? Jobs that each pay taxes towards the U.S. government. So, again, it shows the vast numbers that employment is consisted of when it comes to TikTok. Now, the next category also is very important, the total taxes. I just mentioned that. That's supported by the small businesses. How much are we looking at? $5.3 billion it contributes to the U.S. government. I mean, this is money that the U.S. can spend, albeit the U.S. doesn't spend this money on some wise things that it should, like its own citizens. However, $5.3 billion, that's quite a lot. So, again, it shows the company how it is positive when it comes to an outlook on it. But the U.S. obviously doesn't think so for a variety of reasons. Next up, contribution made by helping the SMBs. This would be how the different categories of people who are involved in these categories and the contributions that are being made. $14.7 billion. So the different categories of the economy in the U.S. where there's contributions that are being made and money is being generated by this company. And our final look comes to the side businesses of TikTok. This is pretty important that they generate income. The total contributions towards the U.S. GDP for the year 2022 in this case, $8.5 billion. Again, these are big figures. Total jobs supported by TikTok's operations, 59,000 jobs there. And in terms of the taxes, that's always important because that's the money that the U.S. government makes, $2 billion. So there, let's bring back our guest, Steve Gill, former White House trade advisor. Steve Gill, welcome back. I mean, we're taking a look at this U.S.-China rivalry when it comes to TikTok. And you're looking at anti-trade moves by the U.S., which is somewhat shooting itself in the foot. Here we have how China has somewhat distanced itself, though it keeps the U.S. going, expanding with BRICS, which is a perfect example of a trade bloc. Don't you think U.S. moves in this light is hurting its own economic standing?
I think that most Americans, unfortunately, aren't fully aware of the development of BRICS and the economic threat it is to the United States if we stay on the outside rather than participating in those kind of economic alliances. I think if you ask most American about BRICS, they're going to think you're talking about a building material that you build a house with, not the economic powerhouse that is developing right under our noses. I think one of the difficulties of what the U.S. policies have been towards Russia, particularly with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, is that we have pushed Russia away and right into the arms of China, which, as I mentioned before, is our biggest economic, military, and really global political adversary. Russia actually has much more aligned with America. I was recently in Moscow for the elections, observing them as an election observer. And the Russians love Americans. They love America. They have an affinity towards America and Americans, which I found refreshing, considering the fact that our media and our politicians have demonized Russia, Russians, and certainly President Putin. And yet they still want to be friends and partners with us, the United States. We ought to take advantage of that. We ought to build that relationship rather than push Russia closer and closer to China, building an even greater military, economic, and political adversary in the world. So I think that we're making a mistake policy-wise to push those who, if they wouldn't be friends, could at least be partners in some ventures, including perhaps Iran as well. We have a bullying policy, unfortunately, I think, in U.S. government right now that is not what we used to do in this country, which was lead. We do much better as a nation, and I think the world does much better if America leads with partners and with economic adversaries, but by not making them enemies, if we lead rather than bully, if we focus on moving together rather than pushing people apart. And I hope the U.S. government will start to figure that out. What I've found in travels all over the world for 30 years or so, people get along pretty well. Governments don't. And I found the same in Russia recently. I was in Turkey. I've spent a lot of time in South America. People get along very well. Governments don't. And the more that we can have communication and interaction between people, the safer the world will be and the more economic progress we can all make.
Time now for the quick take section of the program. We, by the way, no longer have Mahdi Abbasian with us. This is the new format for now that we're going to go with our quick take section. So we know that the House lawmakers have once again passed legislation that could lead to a nationwide TikTok ban. The move could fast-track a proposal that TikTok has been fighting against for weeks at this point. If the House succeeds, then TikTok will actually be forced to find a new owner, or it's going to be banned from the U.S. entirely. But the most important part of this deal is not something that is actually well known to the general public and may lie at the heart of this deal. First of all, what makes this deal actually different, I should ask? Well, there are a few things. For starters, there are some substantive changes. Instead of a six-month deadline, TikTok would have roughly 9 months, and that deadline could be extended by the White House for a period of 90 days, if President Joe Biden determines that there has been progress toward a sale. So what if TikTok gets sold to someone else? Well, the trouble is that TikTok's parent company is subject to Chinese law and that the Chinese government on record opposes this sale. But here is the most interesting part of the TikTok story. Well, in recent years, China has actually implemented export controls governing algorithms. You don't need to know algorithms technically what it means, but basically they are things that would push the consumers into making choices. And it would seem to cover the incredibly successful part of TikTok's recommendation engine, so to say.
Any ban on TikTok is not just banning the freedom of expression. You are literally causing huge harm to our national economy. We have small business owners that are here and small business owners from across the country that use TikTok to move our economy forward.
I am here today to stand alongside of some of my colleagues and these creators to say, not only am I a no on tomorrow's TikTok ban bill, but I'm a hell no. I am highly concerned about our data being collective and being misused by both foreign adversaries and also domestic companies. But this bill does not fix that problem. Let's be honest here. This bill doesn't fix it. We could pass this. It could get signed tomorrow. I hope it doesn't. And in 6 months, in a year, we'll be back at the same conversation, possibly talking about some other social media platform that's misusing our data.
All right. Diane Sayre rejoins us. Diane Sayre is an independent candidate for the U.S. Senate from New York State and also a political analyst. Diane Sayre, welcome back. So we are taking a look at the paranoia that the U.S. has about China, whether you agree or not, citing it as basically a security threat, a national security threat, as it says, like it did with Huawei and a host of other anti-China measures that the U.S. has taken, like targeting Chinese chips. Isn't this about preventing China from advancing economically?
Yes, I think it is very much. And I think it's really silly because the United States could prosper. The United States could prosper We could decide, rather than spending billions of dollars on weapons of war, to invest in building a modern high-speed rail grid or water management or upgrading the family farms or fixing our roads or any number of things that urgently need to be addressed and brought into a modern era. If we were doing that, I don't think we would feel so threatened by China, quote unquote. It's when you have this kind of opinion that we have to somehow be the world hegemon, no one is going to surpass us. And then, of course, we say that and then we also implode ourselves. So we're creating an ever lower and lower bar.
In conclusion, this whole TikTok issue comes down to the U.S. aggressive policy vis-a-vis China, instead of actually listening to its own description of China, a competitor, as the U.S. has said. Well, the U.S. has set out on a wrong decision when it comes to TikTok, like moving to ban it, which would set a very bad precedent for other companies outside of the U.S. who want to enter the U.S. market. Another case of the U.S. shooting itself in the foot. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikami Tawai and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Tuta family had spent a fortune on setting up a pharmacy in Gaza City. It has been in business little more than 2 years when the Zionist regime launched the current genocidal war. When Israel ordered a mass evacuation from the northern part of Gaza on October 13th, the family had no option than to leave. Al Zaytun, the neighborhood which the pharmacy was located, had been subjected to extreme Israeli regime violence during previous attacks on Gaza. They went to stay with a relative in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. Back in their pharmacy, they left medical supplies, estimated at $90,000. From those stocks, they just took some blood pressure medication for Fatima, the mother of the family. They stayed with their relatives for more than 50 days. Then
they were uprooted again, this time taking shelter at the European Gaza Hospital near Khan Yunis. They were still at the hospital in late February when they heard of a major Israeli regime offensive against Az-Zeytun. It took a number of days before they learned the terrible news about what happened to the pharmacy. After repeated attempts, Momen Tuta, one of several pharmacies in the family, was able to contact his friend Azam. Azam went to check on the pharmacy and informed Momen that it was completely destroyed. Azam said everything was gone. It was all burnt out. The family had taken an enormous risk to open the pharmacy in the first place. As well as borrowing money, they sold the 350 square meters piece of land which they owned. All of the family were involved in the business. The siblings, who were not qualified pharmacies, helped with such tasks as marketing via social media and delivering supplies. Before they opened the pharmacy, the family had been in a precarious situation. Fatima was supposed to take medication every day, but she could not afford to. When the family incurred debt to put the children through university, Fatima took less medicine than the prescribed dose so that she could save some money. Of Momen's first thoughts on hearing that the pharmacy had been destroyed was that his mother would no longer have enough medicine. Their story is far from exceptional. For the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has been laying waste to Gaza. Everything that families invested in is being annihilated. According to Press TV, the Zionist regime's relentless aggression against the Gaza Strip has now stretched over 6 months and shows no sign of abating, despite international calls for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime launched the war on Gaza on October 7th after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged the surprise operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying entity in response to the Israeli regime's decades-long campaign of violence against Palestinians. At that time, the Israeli regime said attacking Gaza had two goals: eliminating Hamas and bringing back the hostages taken by the resistance group to Gaza. None of them have been achieved so far. About 130 of the 250 Israeli captives taken during Al-Aqsa Storm are still in Gaza after a provisional truce deal in December saw the exchange of a number of prisoners between the two sides. The conflict in Gaza has taken a devastating toll on Palestinians, with over 33,200 people, including 13,800 children, having lost their lives in 180 days of war, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health. On top of that, around 76,000 people have been wounded, about 4 out of every 100 people in Gaza. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said recently some 1,000 children in Gaza have lost one or both of their legs. A record-breaking 176 UN staff members and 6 foreign aid workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. The Israeli regime army has killed the largest number of journalists of any modern conflict and abducted more than 24. More than 140 journalists have been killed during the 6 months of the war in the Israeli regime's military raids, bombardments, and missile attacks across the Gaza Strip. The humanitarian situation in Gaza has worsened day by day as the Israeli regime army continues to prevent aid from reaching the region, resulting in starvation being utilized as a tactic of warfare, as over a million are at risk of starvation, with international groups warning of an imminent famine. At least 27 Palestinians have already died from malnutrition and dehydration, according to international NGOs. More than 80% of Gaza's population, over 1.9 million Palestinians, have been intentionally displaced as the Zionist regime military ordered Palestinians to go south from the start of the war. Some 1.4 million people are believed to be sheltering in Rafah, a small city on Gaza's southern border with Egypt, which is being bombarded by the Israeli forces every day as they have left no safe zone for the Palestinians to live. The estimated $18.5 billion in damage has affected public service infrastructure, resulting in 26 million tons of debris and rubble. Over 290,000 housing units, equivalent to 62% of all homes in Gaza, have been damaged or destroyed by the war, leaving more than a million people homeless. Only a fraction of hospitals, 10 out of 36, are operational following severe damage, leading to overwhelming strain on their limited resources. Ashifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in Gaza, has been left severely damaged and burnt after enduring a relentless two-week-long siege. The compound, which witnessed the loss of at least 400 lives and the arrest of hundreds, now faces a dire situation. With an acute shortage of medicine and healthcare professionals on the brink of exhaustion and starvation, the majority of patients in Gaza are unable to receive the treatment they desperately need. The scarcity of resources has forced medical teams to carry out operations and amputations without the availability of anesthetics, further exacerbating the already dire circumstances. On March 6, South Africa filed an urgent request with the International Court of Justice and requested for additional provisional measures issued on January 26. In January, the ICJ ordered the Zionist regime to refrain from any acts that could fall under the Genocide Convention and ensure its troops commit no genocidal acts against the Palestinians in Gaza. Israel described the genocide allegation as baseless. Recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling for a halt to all arms sales to Israel and for the regime to be held accountable for possible war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Moreover, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution last month demanding an immediate ceasefire for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The resolution is the first to be approved by the Council after three previous attempts during the past 5 months of war were vetoed by the US regime. Meanwhile, during the month of war, protests around the world have been held in support of Palestine, calling for an immediate ceasefire and halt to arms sales to the Zionist regime.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As the world celebrated 30 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, protesters assembled in their thousands in London calling for an end to the Israeli apartheid and echoing the global demand for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We are here to call for the victory of the Palestinian struggle, that for us it means the end of this genocidal war against Gaza, against the West Bank for us, and against all the Palestinian people.
It's not in our name. We are selling, England is selling arms to Israel, and it's got to stop. They're creating genocide, and we don't want any part of it.
At the destination of the march in Hyde Park, speaker after speaker, including Northern Ireland's First Minister Michelle O'Neill, called out the American, European, and British governments' complicity in the Israeli regime's crimes.
Peace is all.
The march came only weeks after the British Prime Minister gave a Downing Street address condemning extremism and saying the protests risked descending into mob rule, and his counter-extremism commissioner claimed London was becoming a no-go zone for Jews.